Hello, I'm Joe Morrison, and you're listening to Generous Questions, which is a podcast about philosophy from Queen's University Belfast. This episode is with Nancy Jecker from the University of Washington. Nancy came over to Queen's to talk a workshop that was held by my colleague Tom Walker. It was a workshop on the ethics of chronic illnesses, and that's an interesting topic. You might know there's a lot of philosophical work dedicated to the ethics involved in healthcare. We call that medical ethics. And medical ethics usually concerns acute illnesses and the way that it's permissible to intervene in people's lives and interfere with their bodies. And quite a lot of work has been done on the general idea that some of these interventions are going to have some sort of cost-benefit structure about improving people's lives or their bodies. So we can interfere or intervene because we're making people slightly better or we know what's in their interests. But this workshop in Belfast concerned chronic illnesses. So those are illnesses that aren't going to go away or improve very much. Usually they're things that people get in older age and they tend to have several chronic illnesses at once. So yes, an interesting topic, and it's one that we're going to talk about a bit more in the future. We're going to find out more about what Tom's doing in a later episode. He's got a book coming out about it. So he'd invited Nancy Jecker to speak as a keynote at the workshop, and I grabbed half an hour to speak with her about her work. And we did the interview in a bit of the university that turned out to have some unusual background noises. You may hear some lawnmowers mowing and some doors banging, and I hope that's not too distracting. Do you drop me a line? You're welcome to get in touch. I'm on Twitter at Dr. Joe Morrison. That's all one word. And you can let me know what you think about this episode or about the podcast more generally. The website for the podcast is generousquestions.co.uk. I'll put some links to Nancy and her work in there in case you'd like to find out more about what she's working on. And I'll put some things in the show notes for this episode as well, so you can find those just by looking through the device that you're currently using to listen to this. So on with the interview. This is Generous Questions, and we're speaking with Nancy Jecker from the University of Washington. Okay, if you were to introduce yourself to someone who, in a kind of professional context, how do you normally introduce yourself?
Not in a very creative way. I usually talk about my position.
Okay,
so I'm on the faculty at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle, and I've been there 30 years.
Yeah.
And I also have adjunct appointments in the School of Law and the Department of Philosophy, so I go around to different parts of the university, which I really love.
Great. Okay. When you meet with students and they... Do you kind of give them any guidance on how they should address you? Do you say things like... Do they always just say professor and then you let them say professor? Have you thought about, like, a policy around...
That's interesting.
Titles and that kind of stuff.
That's interesting. I'm the director of graduate studies,
right.
So with the graduate students, I think of them more as colleagues than students. They're physicians primarily, and I collaborate with them often on papers.
So you could be saying doctor to them, and they would be saying professor.
So we call each other for our by
good,
first
right,
name.
Good, right,
you
have to.
Yeah, that, you have to. And actually, I'd probably prefer that, but undergraduates... You generally call me Dr. Jecker, which we'd never get in a philosophy department, but it's the norm in the medical school.
Yeah.
The medical school where I am from is a little more formal in the philosophy department.
Okay.
And the titles are a little different.
Because, I mean, here's the thing I came across lately is that there was a discussion where there's a tendency among some parts of faculty to say quite quickly to students or other people, hey, don't call me Dr. Morrison, call me Joe. That would be a kind of familiarity that people are quite keen to use or do, because we think kind of instinctively or something like that, that we're making ourselves more accessible, getting rid of a kind of stuffy pretentiousness, and that seems valuable. But the flip side of that is, at least this is the discussion I was kind of reading about, there are some people who really struggle to attain status within a university to get recognition and that kind of stuff. And there's really a position of privilege or power to be able to throw it away so lightly. So it's the kind of thing that, at least in this discussion, men do quite quickly, and women who have to strive for attention in university situations, maybe this is a UK-specific thing, maybe should be insisting a bit more on, no, don't, you know, you should call me
professor, because otherwise I get called things like Miss or Mrs. That's not appropriate either. That's a discussion I've kind of had my eye on, because I'm kind of aware that the norms around how we're interacting with students in the UK is they're definitely shifting, and there's a different set of expectations coming through with different groups of students. And I find myself kind of scratching my head about what I'm supposed to do about that, and whether I'm just exercising a kind of privilege by being able to say, don't use my title.
So there's a shift toward being more informal with titles and dispensing with them?
Something like I've assumed that that's a natural shift that everyone would want to make. Mm-hmm. And then I've read up on a kind of discussion where people are saying not everybody wants to make that. It's actually more complicated for us to give away our titles. It's quite easy for you, a white man in philosophy, to kind of feel like you can throw your title away, but it's harder for other people. Other people should want to resist doing that.
Right, that's interesting. I've never thought about it in gendered terms or in terms of power hierarchies before, but what you're saying makes sense. I guess in general, I like to think that I have more of a, the high point of my class is always when I'm sitting in the back of the room and the students are in the front.
Good, yeah.
And so I like to equalize it a little and have them think of themselves as active and able to learn from each other.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I try to break down hierarchies. But I do find myself a little offended when a student casually calls me Nancy.
Yeah, right, okay.
Or worse is, like you just said, Miss Jacker.
Precisely, right.
Because I can't. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they do that to everybody, but I do find it offensive, and I don't think of myself as someone who's very formal.
No, precisely, right.
But
right.
I do think there's probably just because of the way I grew up, there's a comfort level with having that, and it doesn't necessarily have to be pretentious or create barriers.
Yeah.
I can still be very accessible, but be the person who's running the class.
Yeah, and that's the thought, is that somehow you want to be accessible, but you also want students to kind of recognize, not constantly recognize, but sort of to recognize that, or to be aware that if you're going to use something other than professor, then it needs to be kind of on the right terms or something like that. It needs to be negotiated.
It needs to be negotiated. I always, when I'm interacting with others, I just assume a title unless they give me permission not to use a title. So it's part of a recognition and respect.
Yeah.
It's not just a word. It's part of recognition and respect.
Yeah, good. Okay.
Because we're equal in some sense, but in another sense, I've had the luxury of thinking a lot about these ideas for many, many years. Yeah. So we're not equal in another sense.
Let me introduce you to some of the thoughts I've had. That's right.
So I think it's a recognition of that.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
Cool. Okay. So that's something that I've been thinking about a bit. It's sort of on... It's on my radar again, and I'm not really sure why. I guess it's just this anxiety building up to the start of term, and I'm thinking about how we're going to meet new students soon and how I want them to find it easy to get into university. And I'm aware that things like titles are a kind of barrier sometimes, and that it can create anxiety for them, and I'm trying to think how best to smooth that over. So that's something that's kind of been on my mind. But tell me what you've been thinking about.
What have I been thinking about?
Yeah, what have you been wrestling with lately?
I've had some strange thoughts. So I spent the summer in Japan, in University of Tokyo, and I visited what's called Aitaiho Toro, which are corpse hotels.
Okay. Corpse hotels?
Corpse hotels.
Okay.
Hotels for the newly dead.
Okay.
And they came about in the last 5-7 years in metropolitan areas like Tokyo, where there is a shortage of space in crematorium.
Wow.
And they don't have anything to do with the newly dead while they're waiting. And so there's a storage problem. And it's not just happening in Tokyo. It's happening in aged and super aged populations everywhere.
Wow, okay.
In Hong Kong, it's happening in UK, it's happening in US. There's in a sense, older people die at higher rates than any other age group. So we have to think about the question I thought about this summer was, what are our duties to the newly dead?
And the emphasis is on newly dead there.
In the book I'm writing, I talk about the long gone.
Okay.
Yeah. So I talk about archaeologists and Native Americans, and I talk about those issues, but it wasn't my focus this summer. My focus this summer was the newly dead.
And in particular, because there's this... So this is a logistical problem around kind of storage and warehousing.
It starts off that way,
right.
But it runs much deeper. And what interests me are the underlying values. And it becomes a practical, pragmatic question. What should we be doing?
Yeah.
should we be treating the newly dead like ordinary objects? How do we reconcile the fact that they are connected with a narrative history? And I like the motif of a narrative, and I argue that part of a good death is respecting the dying and the newly dead, and that in many societies, in many different ways, we find ways to do that.
So there's an explanation of the sociological phenomena of people going through ritualistic steps to create some sort of, I guess, emotional distance or maybe respectful distance between someone who was recently alive until they can get used to the stage of thinking about that person really being deceased. So we're kind of easing ourselves into...
Well, it's not just for self-comfort.
Okay.
It's not just for the living.
Yeah.
It's also a matter of there's a narrative, and that's the story of this person.
Okay.
And at the moment of death, it doesn't stop abruptly. You know, as someone lies in a hospital bed awaiting burial or cremation or whatever the rites are in their society, their story is still happening.
Good.
And how that final chapter is written is not, you know, it's in others' hands, but it is still their narrative. And so part of showing respect and care for a loved one or someone who's newly deceased is to treat them with a certain dignity and to take responsibility for ending a story well.
As part of that, I mean, I'm interested by the use of your term story. As you said, there's a kind of narrative there. And that's made me think a bunch of other sort of philosophical thoughts that kind of I can see tying into that. People thinking about a narrative conception of self.
Precisely.
The self itself is constructed by the stories we tell around people, and their identities consist in part of relations that are born out with other people and those kinds of things.
It's not necessarily tied to a biological process.
Good, yeah.
There's biological death, which in Japan is marked by the cessation of cardiac function. There's biological death, but that the story can continue after biological death, or some would argue can end before biological death. It's really distinguished from the biological process.
Great.
It's the story that sort of hovers around it. I like to use the example because kids in Japan read this book of A Very Hungry Caterpillar, where Eric Carle tells about the metamorphosis of this caterpillar into a butterfly, and then one separates the story and the biological process of metamorphosis, and that story could have started sooner, could have ended sooner, could have gone on. It was up to Carle how he was going to end it, when he was going to end it, the timing.
When the caterpillar's story is over, because now it's a butterfly story.
Right.
So I guess the question I was thinking about on the way into that, when you first sort of talked about stories and narratives, is to what extent you're thinking about the newly deceased person having a role in telling a story about themselves, even though they're newly deceased. So we get things like wills or instructions for things that we should do after they've died that we might feel that we need to honor because it's part of that story. Is that part of what you're talking about here as well?
It can be part of it, but I think there's a tendency to privilege midlife preferences. So I think one looks at the whole story of a life and a good closure for that story.
Good, yeah.
And I think you're right that the protagonist in the story is no longer sole author.
Yeah.
And maybe that authorship was ceded to others long before death, biological death.
Yeah.
In the case of someone with advanced dementia or someone who had other sorts of medical problems where they no longer were authoring their own story or fully authoring their own story.
Yeah.
I think, in fact, across the lifespan, it's a shared authorship. You think about small children, and they are not the sole authors.
No way. That's right.
So it's a give and take, and it's life stage patterned.
Okay.
And after death, it certainly rests in the hands of others.
Right. But
the narrative view, I think, is gaining popularity among philosophers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
It puts a finger on what we think is really important when we think about our own survival.
Yeah.
We don't just think about a body continuing. We think about our lives continuing in some broader sense, the story that we tell that is our lives.
Yeah.
And so I think it captures something significant. It also has practical uses in a medical setting of the sort you're describing, where you're trying to make decisions about someone with dementia.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that we do poorly is when we think about these decisions for someone who was previously competent and now lacks decisional capacity, is we take a time slice, and often it's midlife, and in the form of an advanced directive, a durable power of attorney.
Yeah.
And we think of that as authoritative.
Yeah.
I think when we think narratively, we need to think about the whole story of a life.
Good, yeah.
And
yeah.
not just the midlife time slice.
Yeah.
And that includes the person now. It includes the person that. It includes as much of the story. That's all who the person is.
Yeah.
And to be really autonomous is to be self-determined, not just to be determined by a time slice.
Yeah.
It's the whole person over time, because we don't exist at time slices. We exist from birth to death.
Yeah, yeah.
So to be really self-determined to have one's true self determine one's course is not just look at what this prior competent, because I'm still me, in the sense of it's still my story.
Yeah.
So I think we need to think much more broadly.
These are really kind of metaphysical questions in that sense. Obviously they have this ethical bearing, but they're very metaphysical questions about selves and about identity.
Very much so. Very much so.
And you've written about this previously. So, I was just looking up before I came along here that you have this 2012 article, which is about the non-identity problem, about modifying or genetically modifying children or making selections about which children are going to be born and those kinds of questions. And so the non-identity problem is precisely a kind of metaphysical question about how we can make judgments about what should happen about the birth of a child or the continued existence of a child when we have these metaphysical questions. And you've worked on that previously.
Yeah, I'm smiling because I did my PhD on that.
Okay, cool, right.
Years ago, it was 1984, I was looking for a topic, and cool. Derek Parfit published this amazing book, and I read it cover to cover, and I'm just blown away. I thought he was one of the best philosophers I'd ever read. So I thought, this is what I'm going to do.
Great.
And it was new, it hadn't been worked over, so it was just right.
Ready, just ready
and
for
since
this.
Since I didn't speak German, I wasn't really thinking seriously about Kant.
I can do this, And since then, you've moved away from things
I've moved away from non-overlapping future generations, but I still have an intergenerational theme.
Yep.
I'm just more focused on extant elderly people
and
not so much on the distant future.
Do you feel like this is a kind of, I don't want to say paradigm shift, but something like that there's been all this work that's been on the kind of Parfit style non-identity problem, and that now people kind of, it's not that they've solved it, right, or something like that, but that we have a sort of sense as to how those debates are playing out and actually looking at other parts of, other ramifications of that kind of question, like you say, towards the end of life, instead of this question about what's done before someone's born.
I think in some ways Parfit's been renewed because there's been so much focus on climate change and environmental ethics has become more prominent, and the questions about obligations to non-overlapping future generations have emerged again and with more interest.
Yeah.
But I think that obligations to the elderly and between living generations, it's a big sleeper issue in bioethics and in philosophy. In the 21st century, it's really going to hit us because nearly every nation on the planet is aging.
It's an aging population,
We're going to face questions we haven't faced before.
Yeah.
Because the ratios are all askew. If you look at the proportion of elderly versus young and working age, it's just really dramatic. I mean, we've been aging for as long as records have been kept on societies, but the pace
is
just so quick.
Yeah.
And
the only thing that springs to mind, and it doesn't change that trend drastically at all, is just that there's something that I saw recently that suggests that in the last few years we've seen in the UK and the US a kind of slide in life expectancies, that instead of getting longer year by year, we've seen them ever so slightly slide back. I mean, it's not enough to change the aging population in general. We're still aging out as a population.
Right.
But the idea that life expectancies are starting to not get longer, but to decrease slightly, that's a kind of shocking thought about
a plateau.
Yeah. About our current condition. I mean, one thing you might think is, okay, there's just only so much that we're able to kind of maintain without messing things up for ourselves. The other is, it looks like politics is going wrong if it's letting, particularly around issues about welfare and healthcare, if it's letting this happen. There's something is going on there. I mean, do you find yourself wanting to interact with those, should we say, political or policy-facing questions?
Mostly in terms of how we need to retool healthcare systems to deal with patients who have chronic disease.
Good, yeah.
Because we have such a curative model and an acute care model that's hospital-based, but in the 21st century, most of our problems are going to be chronic progressive diseases that you can't fix and they only get worse.
Yeah.
And the need is for low-tech social care services.
Yeah.
So that's, who's going to care for the dependent elderly?
That's right, right.
It's not going to be the adult daughters.
No.
It's not migrant workers, but they're paid so poorly. I have a theory about that. I think it's going to, I think we're going to need all hands on deck.
Yep.
And it still won't be enough. So we're going to need everything. But I think one of the things that's going to help is with the workforce supply is robots.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you see it in Japan.
That's the dream, right? I suppose. Because the alternative is, as you say, it's all hands on deck. I mean, the other alternative, and the cynic in me, the political cynic, thinks, no, if you maintain something like austerity measures that we've seen in the UK for nearly 10 years now, if you allow by political decisions that social care diminishes in a population, then you can just expect, hopefully, more and more people to die. That there might be an expectation that you just allow to happen because it's a solution to a different kind of problem. But that's me being very cynical about the political decisions that are being made here. But you're right. There are the other view, I suppose, is that technology could save this, right? And you think that is that borne out in Japan? I mean, do you think that's the hope there? Right?
I originally wanted to study that problem when I went to Japan, but I think I'm about 20 years ahead of.
Right.
It's not quite there yet. It has a ways to go still, but I could see it happening, and there are pilot studies being done there, trying this out. And so I think it's just a matter of time. It's not a question of whether, it's just a question of when and how we're going to do it and whether we do it well or poorly. I think personal robots, they already have their robotic pets, and it's not just in Japan, it's in other highly developed countries.
But it's notable in the case of Japan that it is putting pressure on some of their policies around immigration, because until the robots are ready, they're having to think seriously about letting more people come and look after their elderly populations.
Right, and you know, that has its own problems.
Yeah.
I spent last spring in Singapore, and I was in conversation with women from low-income countries like Sri Lanka and India and the Philippines, who were domestic migrant workers who were caring for elderly Singaporeans.
Yeah.
And I heard their stories and talked to them at length. And it's not just the wages are low. There's not a lot of protection of their rights and their work hours.
It's a type of exploitation as any other is going to be.
Very much so.
Yeah.
So I think the term that's used is a global care chain.
Good, right.
The movement of labor across borders where you have care workers who from low and middle income countries that tend to go to high income, more affluent countries.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, like Singapore, Hong Kong, places in Europe.
And so the picture you have then is of a sort of smoldering volcano that this is, I mean, certainly there's going to be ethical problems around, as
there
I say,
are
the kind
ethical
of the, there are ethical problems around the global medical supply chain, as it were,
exactly.
for care.
Yes.
And then there's also going to be similar problems that we're going to think about, or there are going to be other ethical issues that we relate to the care for people who are suffering from chronic illnesses, where we think maybe technology can solve that, and we have to sort of think through what that really means to say we're going to let people be looked after by robots in the future.
Well, I think we have to look at the live options on the table.
Yeah.
The live options are a low-wage worker who's exploited from a low-income country, or an adult daughter or daughter-in-law who's foregoing opportunities.
Yeah.
And if you look at the demographics of how many working age per elderly there are, you have, you know, things like in China, they call it the 4-2-1 problem. So in the one-child generation, you have two elderly parents, and then you have four elderly grandparents, and one child is responsible for all of them. So it just becomes unwieldy.
Absolutely.
Because the ratios are so off. That's what population aging is. It's not about the numbers.
No.
It's about the ratios being all askew.
Just not going to change,
And that's the nature of the beast.
Wow.
So it's not a matter of unpaid adult daughters and daughters-in-law handling it all, and it's not a matter of, I think we really need everything we can get, and it still won't be enough.
And so is your impression that this is, right now, a fully-blown crisis?
Or? I think it's a huge problem.
Right.
I mean, right now we have three so-called super-aged societies where one in five people are over the age of 65, so Japan, Germany, and Italy.
Wow, okay.
But by 2050, we'll have many more.
Yeah.
And by the mid-century, About half the world will be 65 or over.
Wow, okay.
So it's just a sleeper issue, and it's going to really explode
yeah.
in the places people are not thinking about, like Africa.
Yeah.
It's going to okay. really explode in the developing world because yeah. it's aging so much faster there.
Wow, okay.
And they're going to get, as the World Bank says, they're going to get old before they get rich. They yeah. won't have the infrastructure, yeah. and they're going to age much more rapidly than the developed world
wow,
aged.
Okay. That's... I mean,
that's scary.
That's the thing. I mean, so when you think about the work that you're doing and that your colleagues are doing on these issues, do you think of yourselves as trying to, shall we say, sharpen these points so that people who are looking at policy actually have tools to go to? Is that the kind of job for bioethics? Is that what bioethics does?
That's part of it. I think right. it needs to be a global conversation.
Yeah.
The problems are different in different places, but I think we can still learn from each other. Mm. So I'm part of a group at the World Health Organization that's trying to develop an ethical framework for thinking about population aging around the globe.
Yeah.
And I think there is a role for that, and I think it can be helpful. I think how it gets translated in different environments
yep.
is going to vary depending upon resources and culture and what's going on politically and many other factors.
Yeah.
But I think having some ground principles, I like the notion of human capabilities
yep.
from Nussbaum and Zen, and I yep. like the concomitant notion of dignity,
good.
Which is... Unfortunately, it's conceptually a mess yep, when I look sure. at it as a philosopher, but yeah. I think I see yep. that as a challenge. I'm going to clean it up.
Nice.
So I'm trying to work with that concept in conjunction with the notion of capabilities.
Excellent.
So having floor-level capabilities and making a reasonable effort to ensure people have floor-level capabilities.
That's the way of making a framework that looks like it's kind of...
That's the kind of framework.
Universal in that sense.
Yeah.
Something that we can speak to lots of people about. Yeah,
yeah, and I think capabilities, it's been picked up a lot by the World Health Organization and the UN looking at development primarily, but I think there's also a lot of interest in it in this area.
Great. Well, listen, we should wrap it up there. But
okay.
Thanks so much for speaking to me. That's
yeah,
really great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It was great to speak with Nancy. Many thanks to her. And yes, it's fantastic to be stopped in your tracks by ideas that you've never heard of or haven't thought about before. It can be so easy in philosophy to get used to just having a settled picture in your mind of how a particular field or debate is structured. And it's terrific to hear someone saying something like corpse hotels or obligations to the newly deceased. It reminds you that there are so many stimulating subjects out there for you to explore. And it's excellent to remember that there are many people working on fascinating topics. I'm going to keep pressing on making more episodes, talking to interesting people. Thanks to Nancy for being involved here, and thanks to you for listening. You can find out more about this podcast by looking on its webpage. That's www.generousquestions.co.uk. Do keep in touch. Let me know what you make of this. You can share it on Twitter or your Facebooks, and you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher and the other podcast apps. I'm on Twitter @Dr. Joe Morrison. And so until the next time, bye-bye.